Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Earlier this month, more than 500 education researchers signed an open letter to Congress and the Obama administration, urging them to rewrite the No Child Left Behind law as Congress considers its reauthorization. In the letter, they state that test-focused reforms have not only been discredited for high-stakes decisions, but have also shown to widen, not close, gaps and inequities. No Child Left Behind and Common Core have increasingly come under attack by parents, students, and education advocates. We are now seeing a wave of opt-out protests and testing boycotts initiated by parents' groups and teachers' unions across the country. And this movement has supporters of all political stripes. In her new book, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be, today's guest, Anya Kamenetz, an education reporter and parent, writes that she has seen how high-stakes standardized tests are stunting children's spirits, adding stress to family life, demoralizing teachers, undermining schools, paralyzing the education debate, and gutting our country's future competitiveness. Anya Kamenetz reports that the modern era of high-stakes standardized testing has risen from troubling beginnings to become a $2 billion industry controlled by a handful of companies and backed by some of the world's wealthiest men and women. Anya Kamenetz has written about education for 12 years. She's NPR's lead education reporter and the author of two previous books, Generation Debt and DIYU for University. She's also a syndicated columnist with Tribune Media. And Anya joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Hi, Anya. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be here.
It's great to have you. So right now, Congress is going to vote on the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind. And as I mentioned earlier this month, more than 500 education researchers signed an open letter to the Obama administration urging them to rewrite No Child Left Behind. Can you just give us the latest on this?
Sure. So what's happened is that, you know, in the Republican-controlled Congress, the proposals in play right now really are talking about dismantling a lot of the structure that has been put in place and devolving a lot of authority back to the states to do both testing and accountability. And so, you know, the positive side of that, or at least for those who think that there's too much testing, this would remove the federal mandate for annual state, you know, annual tests statewide. But the negative side of that, you know, we're not really having a clear-cut debate about improving tests or moving forward. A lot of people are worried that the pendulum's just going to swing back way too quickly without addressing a lot of the underlying issues that make testing and accountability so problematic.
So it's important to go back in history a bit and talk about No Child Left Behind, because you've got some great information about the history of testing, which we'll talk about. But with No Child Left Behind, I mean, this is when so many children were mandated to take tests, right? So the legislative blueprint was released just 3 days after George W. Bush's inauguration and was initially well received on both sides of the aisle. The law more than doubled the number of federally required standardized tests and declared that all states must test at least 95% of children annually in grades 3 through 8 in reading and math. Why was this such a top priority for the Bush administration?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. You know, if you can bring yourself back to those days, for those who were following politics then, George W. Bush didn't have a lot of accomplishments when he ran for president. And his major domestic accomplishment was what was called the Texas Miracle in education. So he said, I'm going to be the education president. And the Texas Miracle was basically the same template that became the national No Child Left Behind. It was drafted by a Dallas lawyer named Sandy Kress, who went on to a great career as a Pearson lobbyist. And he imposed this idea that instead of decreasing equity in education through improving resource allocation, we can decrease equity in education through rigor, and rigor is imposed through standardized tests. And the Texas Miracle in Education in the late 90s led to instant improvement in high school graduation rates and in the scores on the tests that were being given to students. But even as George Bush was taking office around 2000, 2001, you know, the alarms were starting to be raised by people who were very close to the issues, showing that actually these improvements were really just on paper and that schools responded to the mandate to do all these tests and that they would be graded based on these tests. And they responded to it by moving kids around from grade to grade, by kicking them out and saying that they were getting their GEDs, and a whole lot of other dirty tricks that unfortunately didn't impact quickly enough on our image of what exactly testing and accountability would do when imposed on the national level.
And now you point out something that's really important. Sandy Kress became a Bush presidential policy advisor and simultaneously a lobbyist for Pearson, the largest company involved in creating tests. Kress would go on to be the key architect of No Child Left Behind. What did you learn?
I'm not sure if it was, yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm not sure if it was exactly simultaneous. It was certainly very closely related.
Oh, okay. I was actually taking that right from your book.
Okay.
So talk about why that's really important, because for people who aren't familiar with Pearson, can you explain Pearson and its relationship with testing?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, the testing industry in the United States has always been very small and highly concentrated. There's a small number of nonprofit organizations like ETS and the College Board, and then Iowa Testing and the National the Nation's Report Card tests. Pearson was a publisher, a very, very large English language publisher, that moved into the testing industry much more recently by purchasing a large test grading company, and has come in the last decade, really, with the rise of No Child Left Behind and the testing and prepping that went along with it. They've really, really expanded vastly into this market area and has become what some people call, you know, a testing industrial complex.
Because you also point out that testing has risen from troubling beginnings to become a $2 billion industry controlled by a handful of companies and backed by some of the world's wealthiest men and women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So it is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and the billions of dollars directed, you know, just to testing alone don't really capture it, because in fact the test prep industry is many times larger. And when you look at the workbooks or the worksheets, the testing services and the tutoring, you know, we're looking at thousands of dollars per family and thousands of dollars per student per year, and adding up to really almost the tens of billions of dollars when all is said and done.
And now you come at this from an interesting perspective, because you're now a parent to a preschooler. And so you've been talking to a lot of parents about this issue, and this is also very personal for you. And you also point out that research suggests that when you look at social studies, science, art, music, physical education, lunch, and recess, what happened to these things after No Child Left Behind went into effect, 44% of districts cut time from those activities, and that's according to the Center on Education Policy. Now, I don't have children, and I'm not really familiar with what really changed other than that kids were so focused on testing and not so focused on these other things, but 44%, that's a massive cut.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. And, you know, the amount of time that's given over to test prep in particular, and even just the testing itself, in certain high schools, for example, that I've talked to that have end of course exams that the students have to pass in order to graduate, those are given multiple times with multiple retakes. And so what ends up then happening is that 40 to 50% of class time in certain months of the year, it usually is 2 months of the year, can be given over to the test. And even for the students who aren't taking a particular test on a particular day, it's so disruptive to the entire classroom. And, you know, the ways that testing encroaches on sort of the burden that students and administrators have to take on, and teachers, of course, it can be really subtle. You know, I visited a school in Brooklyn, a middle school, that has an entire dry run. They spend the same amount of time that they spend on state tests. They do it just to practice. And that's an incredible investment of time and resources. This was a school with only 150 students that employed a full-time testing coordinator. And that's not unusual. So the ways that resources are being reallocated, whether that means that you skip recess, whether that means for an individual student that test prep is happening in the mornings, it's happening on Saturdays, it's happening after school. You know, there's so many different ways that the burden of testing and test preparation can come to define the experience of school for millions of students.
And the school that you visited, you call LEAF, but you changed the name of the school, the students, and the teachers so they would speak freely to you. And you were there for the English Language Arts mock exam, and you write that the word of the day is anxiety, both for the parents and the students. Can you just give us a sense of the conversations you had and just what you heard from parents and students and teachers?
Sure. So high stakes is a definition of a test that applies to students, to parents, to teachers, to the school itself, and of course at the district and state level. For this particular school, the teachers' evaluations are depending to a large extent on test scores. The students, their ability to get into competitive high schools in New York City is depending on the test scores. For the school itself as a charter school, if it doesn't make test scores, it's going to be closed in a few years. So one kid told me, you know, he's kind of sitting there with his little fantasy novel, and he says, this is life and death. This is life and death. If I don't get a good grade on this test today as a sixth grader, I am not going to get into a good high school. I'm not going to be successful in my life. And that's an unbelievable amount of pressure to place on a young kid, you know, based on, you know, 3 hours one morning.
And this is actually close to the norm. This is one school that you visited, but you write that this is pretty normal across the country.
Well, that's exactly right. And I mean, I say that the impact obviously differs from school to school, and schools with more resources, especially, you know, higher income schools don't have to worry so much about making their test scores, because these test scores are very highly correlated to family income. And so accordingly, they're spending less time on prep. But the schools that are, you know, dealing with, you know, more diverse populations and lower income populations, they're very much in danger of being labeled as failing and as of closing down. And so the very schools that we know suffer from a lack of resources are the exact same ones that feel the pressure to have all of these extra prep sessions and post the kids' test scores in the front hallways, which I saw in a school in Newark, and really double down and make all of school all about testing.
Do you think the public really understands how testing is affecting children and families? I mean, you write about kids who are throwing up, who are completely stressed out, who lie and say they're sick. You write about Claire Walpole, a Chicago parent, and she blogged about her experience assisting her daughter's class with computer-based testing. Her daughter broke down on the way home on the second day and sobbed, "I just can't do this." The ill-fitting headsets, the hard-to-hear instructions, the uncooperative mouse, the screen going to command modes. It just took 2 days of standardized testing for her daughter to doubt herself. And she said, "I'm just not smart, Mom, not like everyone else. I'm just no good at kindergarten, just no good at all." I mean, this is a kindergarten student saying this?
Right. This isn't even a state-mandated test. This is one of the, you know, the new kind of Common Core-aligned computer-based tests. And, you know, I know that not only parents and the public in general, but even some education experts are not aware of the, you know, intangible impacts or the emotional impacts of the testing, because they are ignorant of it. I mean, I read a report published by a very, you know, self-proclaimed expert, and he said that state tests take only a day to administer, and that's just not true. I mean, when you break down the sections of the test, give them on separate days, and let's keep in mind that once a kid spends the morning testing, they are burnt out and have to spend the afternoon often doing other activities. That's how a test that takes only a few hours in theory to administer can actually end up taking a couple of weeks. So I know that they're not aware. People are not aware of the burdens of these tests, and I also know that we're not aware of the social and emotional impacts because we're not measuring them. I mean, this is exactly the problem, right? We're testing our schools and we're holding our schools accountable for a very limited range of impacts. That's what people are raising the alarm bells around. And we might know something about math and reading proficiency, but we don't necessarily know much about students' attitudes towards school, how teachers feel about going to school, and the general environment that's being created by high-stakes testing. We just don't know.
And you interviewed so many people. Did you ask the decision makers why they're not looking at the emotional impacts of these tests?
Well, I think that the argument that you'll get from testing supporters is that these tests give us better information than what we had before about the performance of various groups of students. And the strongest argument in favor of No Child Left Behind is that it disaggregates results. So we look at, you know, we're not going to be able to implement what George Bush so famously called the soft bigotry of low expectations and pass over the results of minority kids. And that really is the one kind of point that standardized testing, high-stakes testing advocates are hanging this entire structure on. But again, you don't measure, you don't manage what you don't measure. And so if we're not looking at the emotional and social impacts and the overall, we don't have metrics for those things, then the chances that we're going to optimize them are very small.
We talked about kindergarten, but sometimes getting kids ready for tests is even younger than kindergarten, as you found out. As a parent of a two-year-old, this was kind of surreal to read. You and your child went to this class that teaches this thing called Fast. Is it called Fast Track?
It's Fast Track Kids. So,
Yeah, and it's over in over 200 locations in 49 countries. So, tell us about that.
Right. So only a few blocks from my apartment, in fact, I had the ability to take my daughter to what they call, you know, so Fast Track Kids is one of the fastest expanding franchises in the world of any kind. And it is, its entire purpose is basically pre-academic drilling and during the academic year for school kids, prepping and drilling. And so for students as young as 18 months old, I mean, you can't really call them students at that point. They have what they call the discovery class, and they were able to take me for a free sample. And my 26-month-old was put in a room where there was a giant whiteboard, all educational toys, and 3 hours of very close, intensive drilling on counting, on numbers, on shapes, on words. And it's not like I'm against her being introduced to these concepts, but within a framework of, you know, next year when they're 4 years old, then they're going to be ready for the entrance exam for kindergarten to get into gifted programs. And there's a Saturday morning, weeks and weeks and weeks, you can send them for Saturday morning prepping at this place. And then later on, I can have her go there after school in third grade and fourth grade for workbook work. You know, they use a line of workbooks for drilling arithmetic and geometry that is coming straight from Korea. And so there's a little bit of a cram school mentality. And this is really being sold to parents as being, this is what you need to succeed. This is what's going to give your kids the competitive edge that they absolutely need.
Anya Kamenetz writes that good preschools are little Paris salons full of art, music, movement, rivalries, friendships, love, and above all, imagination. Yet just a few years later, when kids enter school, we start to limit our consideration of learning and development to a single hand eye brain circuit, forgetting the rest of the body, mind, and soul. It's math and reading skills, history and science facts that kids are tested and graded on. Emotional, social, moral, spiritual, creative, and physical development all become marginal extracurricular or remedial pursuits. Anya is author of the new book, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. So what are your thoughts on testing? If you've got a child in school, he or she is now taking a lot of tests. What is your reaction to tests and in your conversations with your kids? How are they responding to these tests? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Where do you stand on testing? What are your thoughts on alternatives to testing? And if you have any questions about how this works, we'd love to hear from you. And what was it like when you were in school? I definitely did not take all of these tests. What is the average now, Anya? What does the average kid take a year?
Well, there's a number of different estimates. One of the biggest estimates has 113 standardized tests on average from K through 12th grade. And other estimates have it at between 10 and 20 tests a year, with one of the highest tested years being 8th grade. So it's somewhere in that range. You know, 112 a year breaks down to just under 10 a year. So kindergarten maybe a little bit less, high school a little bit more.
You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org, or you can leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. You also write about the stakes for state tests given annually in schools and how these stakes are just enormous. We briefly touched on this, but do you also think that the public knows about this, that they determine eligibility for grade promotion and graduation? They double as performance metrics for teachers. Schools that fail to meet tests are sanctioned, lose their leadership, or close. You write that in New York, 40% of teachers' evaluations is based on the test. What else do we need to know about just what these tests determine?
Well, one of the biggest ways that the stakes have risen in the last few years under Race to the Top, which is an Obama administration initiative in 2009, states were given heavy incentives to adopt test scores as part of teacher performance ratings. And so oftentimes this is done through an extremely controversial process called value-added measurement. And the reason I say it's controversial, it's controversial from a political perspective, but actually the American Statistical Association, the numbers people, have been saying, you know, know what? This is a really tricky thing to try to do. And what value added means is comparing test scores from kids of 1 year to the next, and then using that change in scores to try to impute something back to the teacher's performance. And there's just so many moving parts to that kind of model.
Well, let's hear from a caller on this. Let's go to Diane in Mill Valley. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, this is a hot topic, and I have been passionately talking to people about it for years. I have a daughter who's in her 20s now. She went through this whole testing, the years of testing, you know. But we almost always opted out. I'm so glad to hear about your book and that this is coming to light, because I've been amazed that people haven't realized this up till now. And I would, you know, in the beginning she took some of those tests, and she didn't do well with the pressure like many kids don't. She didn't enjoy the pressure. She was highly stressed by it, as most kids, I think, are. And I found out this secret that you don't have to take it. And many people, I think a majority, at least historically, didn't know you could even opt out. And I found out, and we opted out, and I went, and you know what? Frequently, and she was all for it, and frequently the vice principal or somebody would call me into the office and want to see me. I'd come in, and they'd give me this big sales pitch and explain how it was going to hurt the school and the funding, which is maybe true. I said, you know what? I'm sorry about that, but this is wrong. I'm against it in principle. I may be one of the three people who does it, but I'm not doing it. We're not doing it. And she would go sit in the art room and do homework and do other things and not be so stressed those couple weeks. And I have another question that relates to this. At that time, they told us, and my understanding was, the grades did not affect their future lives at all, because nobody saw them except it was for statistical purposes. It wasn't like an SAT. So isn't that still true, that if you opt out, it won't, they, I believe colleges don't look at those particular standardized testing scores, or am I wrong on that?
All right, well, thank you for calling in, Diane. Anya?
That's a great question. So more and more parents are finding out what Diane knew, which is that there are very unlikely to be individual consequences for opting out of state-mandated standardized tests. And so that's why tens of thousands, apparently, you know, that's an estimate of families around the country are starting to do this, and they're starting to organize in larger numbers. The question of whether there's an individual consequence for the tests, it's mostly that's true, that you're not going to be, you know, punished or receive any consequences. There are certain situations, for example, if there's a competitive admission to a middle school or a high school, which would be fourth grade or seventh grade year. And then, of course, in some states, tests are actually used to determine grade promotion, which is a purpose for which they weren't necessarily designed for. So in those special circumstances, you may have to arrange for an alternative form of evaluation. It doesn't mean that you have to take a standardized test. But it's very important for parents to know their options, and schools don't publicize this. In fact, they do, in fact, give the hard sell, and many administrations have taken even harder lines by forcing students, for example, to sit and stare or not, you know, sit in the same room as the other students taking the test and not have any books or anything to deal with, and other forms of petty intimidation. But there haven't been, again, any examples of legal consequences that I've heard of that parents have suffered as a result of opting their kids out.
And also, didn't you write that in some places, kids who take the test are given candy in front of kids who are not taking the test?
That was a parent in Chicago in the big opt-out that they had last year who reported this, that his 9-year-old had been forced to sit and watch the kids rewarded with cake and candy.
Wow. We are speaking with Anya Kamenetz about her new book, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. And there's a whole section in her book about how to opt out. And this is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. In a half an hour at 11 o'clock on World Have Your Say from the BBC, the topic will be young Western people going to Syria or Iraq, possibly to join the Islamic State. That's World Have Your Say from the BBC, just a half hour from now here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Sandeep Roy, Morning Edition commentator, editor at firstpost.com, and, of course, former host of this show. He's out with a new novel, Don't Let Him Know. It explores migration, sexual identity, and India's complex social landscape. So we hope you can join us tomorrow with Sandeep. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm speaking with Anya Kamenetz. She is author of the new book, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. And there are so many good factoids in this book. For example, Sandy Kress became a Bush presidential policy advisor and a lobbyist for Pearson, the largest company involved in creating tests. Kress would go on to be the key architect of No Child Left Behind. She also writes about how the Gates Foundation funded the initial development of the Common Core state standards. We learn that Bill Gates' kids go to an elite private school and they don't take tests. So if you have any questions for Anya about what goes on behind the scenes that we don't hear enough about, but we need to hear more about, who runs these, who puts these tests together, how much money is behind this? It's now a $2 billion industry. What questions do you have if your child takes tests? What conversations do you have with your child? Does he or she take tests well? Do they stress about these tests? If you're an educator, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We're going to talk about Common Core in a few minutes. What questions do you have about that? Also, Congress is about to reauthorize No Child Left Behind. 500 education researchers just sent a letter to the Obama administration urging them to rewrite it. They say test-focused reforms have been discredited and have shown to widen, not close, gaps and inequities. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Anya Kamenetz has written about education for 12 years, and she's NPR's lead education reporter. And let's go next to Maria in Hayward. Hi, Maria. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for this wonderful program. I feel that this is so egregious, I can't even have the words for it. But would you please give a description or describe how the very, very, very wealthy, you just mentioned the Bill Gates children, what type of schooling do they have, and why don't we have to measure up to what they get?
Thank you. You know, Anya, honestly, because the Gates Foundation gets so much attention when it comes to, quote, education reform, and as you write, and I'd love to talk to you about this in a few minutes, the Gates Foundation funded the initial development of Common Core. I didn't know that his own children attend an exclusive private school, Lakeside, that does not administer state standardized tests. Can you talk about that?
Well, in fact, most independent schools don't administer state standardized tests because they're not required to, and their students do just fine. And this should really be seen as a ringing statement, a non-endorsement of the usefulness of standardized tests for schools themselves. Because if schools with all the resources in the world choose not to administer these tests, I mean, occasionally, yes, they participate in the NAEP, which is, again, the nation's report card, one of the most trusted and long-term tests been given to students to measure progress. And they participate in PISA, the Program for International Assessment, but they don't give state tests. And for Bill Gates himself, you know, when I got the chance to interview him, I pushed him on this because I really thought about, you know, his own education. He was largely an autodidact, and he was allowed to really seclude himself and pursue his passions without a lot of interference from his school or anyone else. In fact, he did an independent study to teach himself computers. And so I asked him about this and pushed him on it, and he said, you know, he likes to pursue this kind of curiosity-driven learning with his own kids, but he doesn't think that that's necessarily the right kind of approach for the average kid. And that's kind of the thinking that goes into the idea that, you know, what we need to do most of all in our public schools is establish baseline, you know, common denominator proficiency above all else.
Why do you think the Gates Foundation is so involved in education? In your book, The Test, you write that Gates funded the initial development of the Common Core state standards through the nonprofit Achieve, supported charter schools, and in 2009 pledged $335 million to raise student achievement, which is measured through test scores.
Well, Gates Foundation, and I should disclose that, you know, they're a funder of many NPR programs, including our NPR Ed team. They have from the very beginning been driven by the personal interests of the Gates family. And it's Melinda French Gates, in fact, who has had the really long-standing interest in education. Of course, the other big area that they fund is global health and development. And in both and in all their programs, you know, they're very, very much focused on their role as what they call a catalyst. And what that means is they really try to set the terms of debate. They try to create the basis for ideas that others will then follow with policies. And they're very, very interested in metrics. And in the world of health, metrics can be rather straightforward. You know, things like how many malaria vaccines have you delivered, or what is the rate of maternal health, maternal deaths in childbirth? These are things you can track, and the numbers that you get tell you something really important. In education, the outcomes are a little bit more complicated to measure. And so you are either looking at very long-term outcomes of things like people's longevity, their mental health, their income, you know, after many, many years of education. Or you can look at test scores, and that is the short-term quick hit to get metrics for things that we can then track and make decisions based off. And so what I see is really, within the Gates Foundation, an attachment to these technocratic ideals that it's possible to use data to better inform decision-making. But unfortunately, in education, it's very, very complex to measure, and so they end up falling back on test scores.
Hmm. We have an email from Sheila who says, the only valid tests are those which help students and their teachers learn what they need to work on within the context of the students' needs, not those developed by men in suits devoted only to capitalist values and making money. It's not all men, we should point out. But Anya, I mean, what would you say to cynics who say this is really about money? Because you do quote Bill Gates in your book, The Test, saying, quote, when you add textbooks, supplements, and assessments together, you're talking about a $9 billion market that's wide open for innovation. You also write about Rupert Murdoch, the CEO of News Corp, who went farther in a 2010 press release when he announced the purchase of Amplify. It's a tech education company which produces tablets and software. And he said, quote, when it comes to K-12 education, we see a $500 billion with a B sector in the U.S. alone that is waiting desperately to be transformed by big breakthroughs that extend the reach of great teaching. So how much is about money?
Well, I mean, the implications of Murdoch's quote are really kind of amazing, because basically he's saying we could get rid of public education and have this be an industry that the government just hands money over to private corporations to create our children's education. And I don't think that's a vision that very many people share. What I look at is sort of a collusion or a coincidence of interests among, you know, many different kinds of, you know, not only industry, but also certain kinds of policymakers and even people motivated purely by ideology. And then and there are, of course, people who have the best interests of kids at heart and really sincerely believe that the best way to, you know, produce equity in education is through the application of test scores and not through, you know, let's say, resources or initiatives to reduce child poverty or many other approaches that could be taken to the problem. And so the profit motive is very, very important here. I don't think it's the only thing you need to look at it to understand why this is going on, because, you know, for myself as a parent, I think we all have to admit that we have our own kind of thirst for data. And it's not just the schools that are pushing the kids into test prep, but it's parents as well. If every single parent acted the way Diane did and just sat their kid out of these test requirements, we'd have a very different educational system. Mm. And so I think it's important for all of us really to look at our own responsibility in this situation.
Do parents understand what changes are happening in the schools? Are they the parents that you interviewed? I'm sure it's, you know, across the board, depending on income level and how many jobs they have, of course. But do they follow all of this? Do they understand these changes?
Well, you know, if you have a child in public school, obviously you're very, very busy. You haven't been following the twists and turns in educational policy over the last decade. And you might just take what's given and sort of accept that this is the reality unless and until you're a little bit more informed, or your child comes home with stomach aches and starts saying they don't want to go to school anymore. So, you know, I don't fault parents for not being more informed, but I really do hope that they can pick up a book like mine and have, you know, take just a couple of hours to familiarize themselves with a broader context. And I've heard back from educators as well who said, you know, I'm all about tests, I give tests, but I haven't really thought through the implications of where these tests came from until now.
Anya Kamenetz is author of The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. She is NPR's lead education reporter, and she's written about education for 12 years. She also has a preschooler, so she is personally also vested in this. And we'd love to hear from you. Where do you stand on testing? What changes have you seen? If you have a child in K through 12, what conversations do you have with them about testing? If you're an educator, where do you stand on this issue? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, because the reality, right, Anya, is this is the future. I mean, for now, in fact, you've got a quote in your book saying that it's actually going to get worse in many ways if in terms of how many tests kids are given.
Well, I think that that is the potential, and I said that because of the advent of the Common Core. You know, many, many people believe that these tests are more difficult than the ones that they're replacing, and for that reason, they're likely to bring with them more test prep and more diagnostic tests and benchmark tests. Now, I didn't necessarily reckon with how quickly the test fatigue would be mounting, and so just during the time between I finished the book and its publication, there's been many, many, many more voices calling for a reduction in standardized testing, but it becomes, you know, a many-headed hydra that's very difficult to slay because each of these tests is being given for a distinct purpose, and they all have constituents, and foremost among their constituents, of course, are the test companies. And so figuring out which tests are unnecessary, which tests are redundant, and actually cutting back on them is going to be a many, many year process.
And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What's really interesting about Common Core is that people across the political spectrum oppose it. And you write that it has actually split the Republican Party. So you've got Glenn Beck opposes Common Core. And then can you just tell us about that split and what it really explains that?
Sure. I mean, again, this is really shifting, but basically, you know, the traditional education reformers and Jeb Bush should be the biggest example of this, are Common Core supporters. And Common Core, you know, was formulated by the state governors, the Council of Chief State School Officers, with a large buy-in on all sides of the political spectrum. And today, you know, the Tea Party is the one that's really come out against it in terms of it being in a symptom of federal control. You know, it's known as Obamacore. And so then you've got the reformers who say this is a technocratic fix and this is a way to increase, you know, school performance. And then others saying, of course, that this is a huge federal invasion and it's totally inappropriate. So my guess would be that the Republican Party in general may be swaying against the Common Core, but there are certainly very prominent supporters of it.
It's also fascinating to read about not only the companies that are making the tests, but actually who's writing these tests. You write that each testing company employs a staff of psychometricians, thank you, with advanced degrees, issues guidelines, and reviews most test items. But both the writing of actual test items and the grading of student writing is often farmed out to independent contractors making as little as $15 an hour. These workers, some of whom you've spoken with, are not required to have relevant degrees or any experience in education. And so these are the people actually writing the tests?
That's exactly right. Well, if you think about the volume of testing that has to happen, test items, there are hundreds of test items. They have to be replaced pretty much every year. At least the large majority of them have to be replaced to maintain test security and integrity. And tests are given in every single state. I mean, even as the Common Core state tests start to be more common tests, start to be administered to groups of states, we still have a need for thousands of test items. And so the only way to really do that is to employ lower paid contract workers to write them. And that's how you end up with things like the pineapple question in New York State, which was a literature question supposed to be. And the other issue for this, okay, so if you think about, right, so the pineapple question, basically it was a mock fable where a bunch of animals challenge a pineapple to, a pineapple challenges a bunch of animals to a race. The pineapple can't run because it has no arms or legs, and it loses the race, and then the animals eat the pineapple, and then the eighth graders are asked, which animal was the wisest, and why did the pineapple do this? And this question actually appeared on a Pearson test more than once before it caused a huge public outcry in New York State. And, you know, another issue that kind of this kind of points up is the creators of this test didn't want to license actual pieces of literature. So they had the test item writers create this story from scratch, and predictable kind of confusion ensued.
Yeah, that was an actual question. It's not being asked anymore, right?
It was retired after a huge public outcry in New York State. But, you know, it's hard for these kinds of stories to make it out because, you know, teachers are really held under very strict penalties of not sharing any test items. And even students are not supposed to share test items for reasons of test security, they say. Hmm. But what that means is, you know, there's not a lot of transparency and not that many eyes get to see these individual test questions, even as students are being graded on them. And that has serious consequences. You know, an investigation by Heather Vogel at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution found an examination of 92,000 test questions that 10% of the tests that they looked at had blocks of questions of 10 or more percent that were wrong. The questions were wrong. And you could tell statistically by how the students did on the tests that the questions were wrong. And therefore, you know, the odds are that by the time your student gets out of school, they will have taken at least 10 tests on which their grades were probably not correct.
Wow. Anya Kamenetz is author of The Test. And we've got a number of calls. Let's try to get through as many as we can before we end. Let's hear from Miranda in Oakland. Hi, Miranda.
Hi. I graduated high school in 2002. And when I was 16, I organized some students' protests for the standardized Golden State exam. I'm originally from Marin County, which is obviously a very wealthy and privileged county. And I got 2 out of 3 of the high schools in our district to opt out of the exam, to the point where our percentages were skewed enough that they were not able to get funding for the next year, which, you know, has some bad implications, but for such a wealthy school district that earns a lot of money from property taxes and donations from parents, I felt like it was more fair, considering at that time that funding was based on a bell curve. And my question now is, are students still graded on a bell curve?
All right, thank you.
So are students still graded on a bell curve? The standard tests that states take are normed on a population. And what that means is that they have a predictable rate of passage. And they can sort of tell you before the test is even given about what percentage of students are going to pass it. And even more so, if you know the income of the students who are taking the test, you can pretty much predict what their scores are going to be without it. And so the question is really raised then, whether, you know, what exactly we're learning from these tests that they are so highly correlated to family income.
Sarah says, if I opt out, will my school lose money from the state or federal government? Is there any requirement for schools to publish the specific dates and times that kids will be tested?
Okay, so usually districts publish a testing calendar, so that should be information you can get from your school. The connection between opt-out and funding, if less than 95% of any subgroup, so that includes, you know, all students, minority students, students with a learning disability, low-income students, English language learners, if more than 5% of any of those groups opt out, the school is not then in good standing for reporting accountability to the state. The funding that they can lose is not, you know, their not a huge percentage of their total budget for most schools. It comes out of the Title I funding that the federal government gives to schools, and particularly to schools that serve these disadvantaged populations. So, you know, I think a lot of times that danger is kind of overstated. And then, of course, you could always think about organizing an opt-out protest that sits right at that 5% line and doesn't go over it.
All right. Thank you for the email. Let's go to another caller, Joe in San Francisco. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. I was thinking about some of the tests I took in elementary school, like learning your single-digit multiplication tables, 5 times 7 and 8 times 9. And I think, you know, to a certain degree, it's you know, educating and learning is operating the muscle of the brain. And there's no real easy way to learn those multiplication tables except by sitting down and doing the numbers over and over and over until you've learned how to do them. And that's part of what education is, like, throughout your life. I mean, there's a lot of things kids do in elementary school, like singing and playing in the fields and stuff, but I think, you know, a test, when you test something like that, it's saying, hey, did they learn how to do that? If you ask a multiple choice question, if a kid goes and buys two apples for 75 cents, he has $2, how much money does he have left over? You ask a third grader that, it's saying, did they learn how to read? Did they learn how to do some basic math? And if they haven't, that's really a problem, and people should know.
All right. Anya, what are your thoughts on that? Thank you for calling.
I totally agree that teacher-created assessments are, a part of really quality teaching and learning, and that we need basic information about student performance. And I even think that there could be a role in great schools for some kind of reporting of transparency. I mean, the question is just where you draw the line. We're in a situation where everyone from the president on down is saying we have too much testing, we have over-testing, testing is sucking the oxygen out of the room. And so how do we go back to those basics? How do we go back to limiting the role of testing mm-hmm. to where we're getting basic information on what we think is most important for students to know, and not kind of defining the experience of school for so many students and parents? That really is the question.
Yeah, and we'll get to that right before we end. I just want to take one more caller because people have been waiting patiently. Thank you for calling, Joe. Let's go next to Iman in Santa Clara. Hi, Iman. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm trying to mention that the teachers have to be paid well. Otherwise, we can't attract the talented people to education. If you don't have the teachers, there is no point in testing or anything. Without testing or with testing, we can't get any good education. See, I'm working in a different engineering field, but I want to be a teacher. But the payment what I'm getting as a teacher is not sufficient for me to select the job. So we have to have a good paid and highly educated, and those people who are really keen on educating people to come to the teachers' workforce. Then even poor kids, hungry kids also will be taken care of if the teachers are kind and the teachers are so much oriented towards education.
Well,
instead of driving them by measuring their performance on the test.
Thank you so much for calling in. Anya has many examples of teachers who unfortunately have left teaching because of these issues. We just got an email from Shell, who writes a long email about how she had to administer STAR tests for years. She says, I've been so frustrated that there's a week or more of lost time when I can't move forward with my material. The kids are bored out of their minds. Everyone's dealing with paperwork, all of which costs money that could be going to teaching the students. I finally left the public schools. Anya, you heard many stories like this.
I did. And, in the big picture, what we're doing is I think deprofessionalizing teaching, because professionals have the ability to control the circumstances under which they work, and they're given the authority to determine the outcomes of their performance within reason, with and among their peers. And I think that's really, really important. What we're doing here with imposing standardized tests and accountability measures is that we're telling teachers that they don't have the right to decide whether or not their students are learning. And that is something that a high quality professional doesn't really like to hear. And I think that if you want to take a holistic look at school performance, certainly the working conditions of teachers are going to be a big part of that.
Where do you see this going? I mean, the education reform debate has been raging for a couple of years now. And, as we said, Congress is considering reauthorizing No Child Left Behind. You have a lot of alternatives in your book toward the end. Where do you see this going? And, I mean, your child is about to enter kindergarten. What are your thoughts about what she's about to face?
Well, the one area that I find really encouraging, two that I think are connected, is the increasing emphasis on, one is on a sort of expanding the franchise of public education. So at the federal level, we've seen a lot of initiatives toward universal pre-K, and then we have the president talking about free community college. And what both of those things are doing is saying, the responsibility of public schools does not just start and end, between grades 3 and 8 or between age 5 and age 16 or 17, that we really have a more comprehensive responsibility, and it's preparing kids for the workforce on the one end. And in the beginning, it's a lot of social and emotional development. And so both of those things, I mean, both, if you look at workplace demands, what employers really want, you're looking at 21st century skills, critical thinking, communication, and collaboration. And if you look at preschools, you're looking at social and emotional development, getting along, self-efficacy, and sense of agency. And these are all things that are outside the purview of math and reading traditional standardized testing. And so if we agree that those are public priorities, we're going to have to figure out different metrics to measure those priorities. And I think that that could itself lead to a much more interesting take on exactly what we think of as quality school and what is a good school outcome. And if we have a better idea of outcomes, I mean, I'm a big believer in the power of outcomes and the power of metrics and data. I just think we need to get really curious about what kind of data and what kind of analytics are the best, highest quality to promote the outcomes that I think we want to see for all of our children.
Because a lot of people do believe that testing is the best way to measure success, but you write that scores on state tests do not correlate with students' ability to think. A lot of studies have been done about this. They also waste time and money. And so what would you say to someone who says, well, then what are the, I mean, this is a big question, but what are the alternatives to, quote, measuring success? Because that is the key buzzword we keep hearing about education reform.
Well, you know, in economics research that goes back to the 70s, is very hard-edged, finds that half of what students need to succeed, and that's determined by income in these measurements, is non-cognitive skills and things like perseverance. You know, all heard a lot about grit, about growth mindset. And these are the kinds of skills that it doesn't matter how good you are academically, whether or not you believe that standardized tests measure academic skills. You know, we should be looking at different kinds of things too, and a much bigger picture of what success really is and also how to measure it long term.
Anya Kamenetz is author of The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. She's also NPR's lead education reporter. Anya, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for your phone calls and emails. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Sandeep Roy, Morning Edition commentator, editor at firstpost.com, and former host of Your Call. Sandeep Roy's new novel, Don't Let Him Know, explores migration, sexual identity, and India's complex social landscape. What role does literature play in helping us understand other cultures and people? We'll take your questions for Sandeep Roy on the next Your Call with guest host Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.